At the end of last time, we introduced the ontological models framework for talking about at least a certain type of realist interpretation of quantum mechanics. And I gave you some examples of different ontological models. Now what we're going to move on to in the next couple of days is proving which kinds of properties of those models are compatible with quantum mechanics. So there are various no-go theorems, the most famous of which is Bell's theorem. We'll probably get round to talking to that on tomorrow. But I imagine that we will talk about at least these two today and possibly a little bit of that one. Okay, so just as a reminder, this is basically the definition of an ontological model. I laid out several assumptions last time, which was single world realism, independence, measurement independence, and lambda mediation. Those assumptions altogether get you down to this framework. So associated with a system, we have an ontic state space, so a space of states of reality. Each preparation gets associated to a probability distribution over those states. That's sometimes called the epistemic state, corresponding to the preparation. And each measurement gets a probability distribution, a conditional probability distribution over outcomes that depends on the choice of measurement and on what the ontic state is. Okay? So what we do is we combine these two probabilities together and then average over the ontic states, which we don't see directly. And this is supposed to reproduce the predictions of the theory, which in our case is going to be quantum mechanical predictions. That's the basic framework that we talked about. Are there any questions about that setup? Okay. Let's move on. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the excess baggage theorem, or what Lucy and Hardy at Perimeter Institute here proved this. He called the ontological excess baggage theorem. What the excess baggage theorem proves is the fact that even if we have a qubit, even if we have the smallest possible quantum system, actually the ontic state space must have an infinite number of states in it. So why is this a strange thing? Well, first of all, we know that you can only reliably store and retrieve one bit of information inside a qubit, right? There are only two orthogonal states, right? So if I want to reliably retrieve one bit of information, I've got to choose one orthogonal basis to encode that in, and that's all I can do. We also saw that in teleportation, I can transmit the state of a qubit from Alice to Bob by only sending two classical bits. And I argued that this is possibly an indicator that we should think of a qubit as containing no more than two bits of information, because if it contains more than that, then somehow that information gets transmitted from Alice to Bob without any physical transmission of information at all. Now, of course, we know when we're going to prove Bell's theorem, we're going to show that theories have to be non-local. So what you're actually going to have to conclude is that information is transmitted somehow instantaneously, non-locally, when you make the measurement, which is a puzzling thing. Okay, so, but we can prove, you know, without any additional assumptions, that actually there's, in an ontological model of a qubit, actually a qubit contains an infinite amount of information, in principle. Okay, so Hardy's original proof basically only shows that there must be infinite ontic states. This is the one I'm going to reproduce here, because it's straightforward enough for me to go through the full details. But there have been further proofs since that. So Alberto Montina showed actually that the ontic state space must have the cardinality of the continuum. So there's a continuous infinity of states. And also, even if we allow the model to only approximately reproduce quantum theory, right? So if we don't demand exact reproduction, but only reproduction up to experimental accuracy, then the number of ontic states must still be exponential in the Hilbert space dimension, exponentially large in the Hilbert space dimension. So even though you might think, okay, a d-dimensional system contains can you be used to store like a dit of information, d orthogonal states, actually the amount of information required to simulate that is going up exponentially. Okay, so let's see how do we go about proving this. So first of all, I'm going to prove a useful lemma that we will use repeatedly in the theorems that we're going to look at today. So suppose P is a preparation of the state psi, and suppose M is a measurement in an orthonormal basis that includes psi. Okay, so given a pure state, it can appear as a state. It can also appear as an element in a basis, in a measurement basis. Okay, so I'm going to define two sets. The first set is this lambda psi P. So this is all of those lambdas that are given non-zero probability in the epistemic state according to P. Right, so when I prepare psi in this way, these are the ontic states that have non-zero probability. Now, as I said yesterday, I'm adopting physicists' rigor with respect to probability theory and things like that. you have to worry about measure zero issues in principle, but I won't worry about that here. You can make all this much more rigorous in measure theoretic probability if you want to. Okay, so the second set I'm going to define is gamma psi m. So these are all of the ontic states that would give the outcome psi in the measurement of the basis that continues it with certainty. Okay, so this set might be empty because I might have a theory that's always 100% probabilistic, right, for instance, but I can nonetheless define the set, okay? So there are some ontic states, there may be some ontic states that when I make this measurement, always give this outcome. Okay. Then the result that we need is that this support set is a subset of this set, up to measure zero issues, right? So there may be some there may be some subsets of this that are measure zero that's not inside this and stuff like that that you have to deal with. But we won't worry about that. Okay, so why does this occur? It occurs because in quantum mechanics, the inner product of psi with itself mod squared is one. So if I prepare psi and then measure a basis that includes psi, I always get that outcome. So that means if we look in the ontological model, this probability here, the probability of when I prepare psi according to this preparation and measure and get this outcome, that probability must be one. Now, because this set here is the support, this probability distribution is zero outside this set, I can restrict this integration down to this subset here, okay? Now, however, I know that this thing here is a probability distribution. So when I integrate the probability distribution over lambda, I have to get one. And I only have to integrate it over the set on which it's non-zero. So this has to be one, and also this has to be one, right? So I also know that this is greater than zero everywhere here. So it must be the case that this is one almost everywhere, right? Pretty much everywhere on this set, because if it was less than one on a non-zero on a set of non-zero measure, then this would be strictly smaller than that. Okay. So in order to reproduce this probability one, this has to be one pretty much everywhere on the support of the probability distribution, which means that we can effectively think of the support of the probability distribution as being a subset of this set, the set which returns that state always. Okay, so this is a result that we're going to use repeatedly. So does everybody understand that? All right, so now let's look at the excess baggage theorem. So it says that any ontological model that can reproduce the quantum predictions for orthonormal basis measurements on pure states in any Hilbert space dimension must have cardinality infinity. Okay, so how are we going to prove that? We're going to prove it by contradiction. So we're first going to assume that there's actually some finite number of ontic states, right, for some finite n. And then we're going to consider the statistics of some measurements. So we're just going to, we can always reduce this down to a qubit because it's true for a qubit. So if I'm in a higher dimensional system, I can just restrict my attention to a two-dimensional subspace. Let's consider a two-dimensional subspace spanned by two states, 0 and 1, orthonormal states. And then we'll construct these m states right, for j here is going from 0 to m minus 1. This should be a capital M. Both of these should be capital Ms. Right, so if you look at what these states look like, so this is on the equator of the Bloch sphere. Psi 0 is always just the 0 state. And then these states are at equal angles all the way down to m minus 1, which is theta away from the 1 state. Okay, this angle here is theta as well. So basically, by increasing m, we make this theta smaller and smaller. Okay, so we can have as many of these states as we like. Okay, as large, we can choose m to be any large finite number and have this set of states. Now, the important thing is that if I take the inner product of any of these two states, it's less than 1 whenever j is not equal to k. So I deliberately didn't go all the way down to this one, which would be orthogonal to that one. So every pair of states here, they're non-orthogonal, and they're non-identical. So it's so the inner product is strictly, it's non-zero, and it's strictly less than 1. Okay? All right. So now let's consider preparing the system in the state psi j and measuring it in a basis that includes psi k for some other k. Okay? So what do we know then? So because I have a finite number of ontic states, I'm replacing the integrals by sums here. So we're just getting sums over probabilities. So we know that this expression is less than 1. Okay? Note I'm using naughty notation here, where I'm writing this as lambda given a quantum state instead of lambda given a preparation, right? We're only considering one way of preparing each state, and we're only considering, have to consider one way of measuring each thing, so I can do that. So I'm also going to do that for these sets. So I'm just going to call lambda psi, this is the support of the probability distribution, PR lambda given psi. I'm not mentioning the preparation, okay? All right, so, okay. So the first thing we can say is there has to exist a lambda in the support here such that this guy, the probability of getting outcome psi k is less than 1. Why? Because if this was one everywhere on the support of this, then this sum would be 1. Because the sum of this guy on its own is 1. So there must be at least one ontic state such that this probability is less than 1, otherwise the sum would be 1. Okay. Now, if we consider, instead of preparing two different things, preparing and measuring the same thing, then we can basically use the result I just proved, right? So so if I were to prepare psi k and measure psi k, I would find that this has to be equal to 1 everywhere on the support of psi k. And so because this function takes different values somewhere on psi k and somewhere on lambda psi k and somewhere on lambda psi j, that tells you that lambda psi k and lambda psi j have to be different subsets of the ontic state space. They might overlap, but they can't be exactly the same because there has to be some points on this space where this is less than 1, whereas on this space, this is 1 everywhere. Okay? They're different subsets. However, this applies to every distinct pair j not equal to k. So for every pair of states, every pair of states in this set, I can prove that the supports of the probability distribution for every pair are pairwise distinct. Okay, so every j and every k corresponds to different supports. So that means, since those supports are pairwise distinct, there must be m distinct subsets of lambda have to exist, right? Because otherwise they couldn't all be distinct subsets. We need at least m different subsets of the ontic state space. Now, how many subsets of lambda are there? Well, if lambda is a finite set, it has 2 to the n subsets, the power set, right? So every lambda can either be in the subset or not be in the subset. So there are 2 to the n possibilities. So therefore, we require that 2 to the n is greater than or equal to m, right? So that we have at least that many subsets. And if I take the logarithm of that, that tells me that n is greater than the log to the base 2 of m. But it doesn't matter that that's a logarithm here, because we can choose m as large as we like. M can be however large finite number that you like. So n is larger than any finite integer. Therefore, we have to have n going infinity, right, in the limit. So this tells us that there must be an infinite number of ontic states. Does that, anybody have questions about that? Follow the argument? Okay. So, so the reason this is surprising is, again, because we characteristically think of a qubit as at least containing some kind of finite amount of information, right? It contains, depending on whether you think about teleportation or just storing information in a single qubit, it's something like 1 bit or 2 bits of information. This is telling us, actually, no, there's an infinite amount of information in a qubit in some sense. All right. So that's the first, that's kind of the first puzzle that we have. Next thing is contextuality. Contextuality is one of the two, so there's sort of two main no-go theorems that everybody talks about. One of them is Bell's theorem, the other one is the Cauchon-Speicher theorem, which is to do with contextuality. So this is probably the second most famous no-go theorem. I'm going to follow an approach to contextuality that is due to Rob Speckens, again, who's works in this building. I think this is the clearest way of understanding it. So the basic philosophy of this is based on Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles. So Leibniz's principle of the identity of the indiscernibles in one sentence says, no two distinct things exactly resemble each other. Sometimes say it's also the principle of if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it is a duck. So the idea here is that, you know, if by every single observation I can do, I can't tell two things apart, right? Then they should be the same thing, right? There's no physical experiment that you can do that would reveal a difference between the two. So arguably, this principle is very successful in physics. Most obvious example of it is Einstein's equivalence principle, right? You know, Einstein says you can't tell if you're in a sealed elevator, you can't tell the difference between whether you're stationary in a gravitational field or if the elevator is just not in a gravitational field and accelerating. Those feel the same to you, they look the same to you, and so Einstein's equivalence principle basically says those are physically the equivalent. They're just two different descriptions of the same physics, right? So this is arguably an instance of the Leibniz principle being used in physics. We can also think of it as a kind of no fine-tuning argument, right? So suppose we have two objects, right? and we assert that object A and object B are different in some way. However, there's absolutely no measurement that we can do in the lab that would allow us to tell A and B apart. Then, whatever that difference between the two things is, between A and B is, must be, our measurements must be tuned in such a way as to like wash out any difference between them that might have been detected, right? So we must imagine that there's some kind of conspiracy limiting our ability to probe the system in order to not see that difference. So if we assert that there are differences that can't be detected in any way whatsoever, then we must think that our ability to measure is being limited in some way that we don't have any real explanation for. So the appearance of a fine tuning is not necessarily an evil thing. I won't go into this in great detail now, but we can talk about it later. But if you find out that you have a fine tuning in your theory, usually you think, oh, this is something that we need to explain. We need an explanation for this. Okay, so this is the background. So now we're just going to apply this kind of idea to our ontological models. So I'm going to talk about two types of contextuality. I'm going to talk about preparation contextuality first, because it's the simpler one, which it was introduced by Rob Speckens. And then I'll talk about the more traditional notion of contextuality. So for preparation contextuality, what we can do is we can define an equivalence relation on preparations in an operational theory. So I will say that two preparations are operationally equivalent if the probability of every outcome, for every measurement and outcome, they always give me the same probabilities. Okay? So if we have, in particular, we know that if they are represented by the same quantum state, right? If we have a quantum model where they're represented by the same quantum state, then they'll give the same measurement statistics always. So having the same quantum state is one instance of having operationally equivalent preparations. Now, the assumption of preparation non-contextuality says, if we have this operational equivalence, then we should represent the preparations the same way in the ontological model. It says the epistemic states, the probability distributions over lambda, representing them should be the same. So if there are no observable distinctions between the preparations, they're represented by the same epistemic state. And we call a model, if the model fails to satisfy this condition, then we call it preparation contextual. So let me reiterate again sort of the no fine tuning kind of argument here. This here says there's absolutely nothing we can do in the lab whatsoever to tell these two preparations apart. If it were the case that they were they can be represented by different probability distributions, but in order for that to be the case, the way our measurements are represented has to be in such a way to avoid being able to detect that difference. So the measurements are only revealing coarse-grained information about the state of reality, only revealing coarse-grained information about lambda, and we have to imagine that the way they're coarse-grained is tuned in such a way to avoid being able to detect any difference between those two. So the idea is that it's much more natural to imagine that actually when two things are always exactly the same, in terms of experimental statistics, that they are in fact actually the same. So any questions about that definition? All right, so there's one more thing that I'll need to construct a no-go proof. We have to consider mixtures of preparations. So if you have any operational theory, you can sort of convexify it. So if I have two preparations, P and Q, then I can consider a mixed preparation, which I'll just write like this, although this isn't a linear space, so this, strictly speaking, doesn't have a meaning, but it's just a notation for a preparation where physically what it means is I'm going to toss a coin which has probability of heads coming up P, little p, and I'll do preparation big P if it lands heads, or Q if it lands tails. And then I'm going to forget the outcome of the coin toss, or I'm going to imagine that the whole thing happens automatically inside a black box and I never know the outcome of the coin toss. So that's what we call a mixture of preparations. And we'll assume our ontological model preserves mixtures in this sense, in the sense that the epistemic state corresponding to this mixed preparation is just the appropriate mixture of these probability distributions. Now, it's a very natural assumption because flipping the coin is nothing to do with the actual physical system I'm investigating, right? There's no reason to imagine that there's some kind of correlations between the degrees of freedom of the coin and lambda. But it's actually, you can derive this, I won't do it here, but you can actually derive this as an instance of preparation non-contextuality if you apply it to the joint system consisting of the coin and the system you're preparing. Because if you condition on the outcome of a coin here, you end up with a preparation that's equivalent to P or Q. And from that, you can derive from preparation non-contextuality that this has to hold. But this isn't really a very important part of the proof, so I'm just mentioning it here. Okay, right. So now let's prove preparation contextuality. This is one of the simplest proofs. Sometimes it's called the Star of David proof here, because you can see there's six-pointed star here. So we're going to consider these six states, which let's imagine this is the equator of the Bloch sphere. So they're evenly spaced around the equator of the Bloch sphere. And those states which correspond to a capital and lowercase version of the same letter are orthogonal. So in a product of big A with little a, big B with little b, big C with little c, they all have inner product zero. And this implies that the intersection of their supports, the support of little a and the support of big A in the ontological model must be disjoint. Okay, so these are the supports. Why? Because by our previous lemma, we showed that lambda psi is a subset of this set, right? So this is the set of lambdas that give you probability one when I measure in a basis that includes that. But there is a basis that includes both a little a and big A here. Okay, so for a qubit, little a and big A form a basis. So that means that when I sum over little a and big A, these probabilities have to be one, because the measurement has to give me some outcome, right? So those have to be one. Right? So since the sum of these is one, the set of states on which little a, the probability for little a is one, must correspond to states in which big A gets probability zero, because they have to sum to one everywhere. So if this is one, then this can't be anything else than zero. Therefore, the intersection of these sets, the sets which give me little a with probability one as an outcome, big A with probability one as an outcome, the intersection of those two sets has to be empty. But these guys are subsets. The supports are subsets of these. So therefore, this guy's a subset of that. This guy's a subset of that. So that intersection is empty as well. So those supports have to be disjoint. So we're going to use that. So the support of the probability distribution here and here, here and here, here and here, those are pairs of disjoint supports. Okay. So the other thing we have, this is where we're going to be using the preparation non-contextuality. The maximally mixed state here in the middle of the Bloch sphere can be written in a variety of different ways. So I can, if I mix these two orthogonal states with equal probabilities, then I get the maximally mixed state, the point in the center. Same if I mix these two, and same if I mix those two. So it's these three decompositions. But also, because these guys form equilateral triangles, if I mix these three with probability a third each, and I mix these three with probability a third each, that also gives me the point at the center. So here we have five different decompositions of the maximally mixed state. So preparation non-contextuality tells us that these mixtures have to give me the same thing in the ontological model. So there's only one probability distribution representing the maximally mixed state, and it has to be the equal mixture of the probabilities corresponding to these two guys, these two guys, these two guys, and also these two ones which have mixture probabilities of a third instead of a half. Okay, so we get five different decompositions, but those mixtures all have to mix to the same probability distribution. All right, so these are the decompositions written again. Now, if you give me a lambda, one lambda, it can only be either in lambda little a or lambda big A. Can't be in both because we prove that they're disjoint. Similarly for the Bs and similarly for the Cs. So we really have, we have eight cases to consider, right? Because I can be in, for example, lambda can be in lambda little a, lambda little b, and lambda little c, or it could be in lambda little a, lambda little b, lambda big C, and so on, right? So in principle, you have to go through all eight cases. I'm just going to do one of them here because they all have the same structure once you see the proof for one of them. So let's choose a lambda that is not in lambda A. So the other thing that we got to, there's a reason for expressing it in this funny way. There's no reason why the union of these two has to be the entire ontic state space. So instead of saying I can be in here or in here, I'm going to say I can be not in here in the complement of this or in the complement of that, right? And that way I've dealt with all ontic states. Okay, so let's choose a lambda that isn't in lambda A, isn't in lambda little b, and isn't in lambda big C, okay? So then what do we have? Well, if we're not in lambda little a, then which one are we doing first? Yeah, okay. We're not in lambda big C. Okay, so if I look at this decomposition down here, since I'm not in lambda of big C, I only get this term. So for that particular lambda, this is true. Now, let's look over here. If I'm not in lambda A and not in lambda B, let's see. Then if I look at this decomposition, these two terms are zero, but this one could be non-zero. So there I have that one. But those have to sum to the same thing, right? So this has to equal that. So in other words, for this particular lambda, two times this guy is equal to three times the same thing, which tells me the only way that can happen is if the probability of lambda for I over 2 is zero for this particular lambda. However, I can repeat the same argument for every possible choice of being not in A, little a, big A, little b, big B, etc. So for all eight cases, I can repeat the same argument, and you'll see that if I choose one of the decompositions over here and one of the decompositions over here, I'll prove that that probability has to be zero everywhere. But doing so exhausts all of big lambda. So what the upshot of that is that this probability distribution has to be zero everywhere, but that can't be true because it's a probability distribution. So you get a contradiction. So the upshot of that is that you just can't have all of these mixtures be equal to the same probability distribution. Some of them have to differ, and that's preparation contextuality. Everybody follow that? That makes sense? I see some puzzled faces. If you ask me questions afterwards as well, I'm happy to take questions afterwards. Okay. Right, so now let's look at the more traditional notion of contextuality, which is to do with measurements. So we can also define an equivalence relation on the measurement outcome pairs, right? So if I have some measurement M with an outcome K and a measurement N with an outcome L, then if they give the same, if they have the same probability for all choices of preparation, then I'll say they're equivalent measurement outcome pairs. So in particular, if in quantum mechanics they happen to be represented by the same POVM element, then you'll have that equivalence. That should be an N. And that should be in italics, but it's okay. It should say MKNL there. And so by the same kind of procedure, we'll say that, okay, if there's no way we can tell these two measurement outcomes apart, there's nothing I can put into the two measurement devices that would distinguish them, then they should be represented the same way in the ontological model. And that means that the response function, or these conditional probabilities, for getting these outcomes, this outcome when I make measurement M, this outcome when I make measurement N, for every value of lambda should be the same. Now, it's definitely possible to not have this and still have a valid ontological model. Let me reiterate that we saw yesterday that you can have an ontological model that reproduces the quantum predictions. We had the Beltrametti-Bugatsky model, we had the Bell model, etc. So you can have an ontological model in which this fails, but again, we view the failure of this as some kind of a fine-tuning, because it says, you know, the probability distributions that I can prepare over lambda have to be insensitive to whatever difference between these two functions is. When I average over the probabilities for any preparation, it has to wash out whatever that distinctness is. So anyway, so a model that doesn't satisfy this is called measurement contextual. All right, so, yeah.
So what you're saying that it's the same physically is the measurement or the state?
So for preparation contextual, so state is the wrong terminology. Well, okay. So for preparation contextuality, right, I have, if two preparations are the same, which will in particular have as a special case of it that the two quantum states are the same, then in the ontological model they have the distributions have to be the same. So I have So, you know, in diagrams, if I have rho p is equal to rho q, then in the ontological model, it would be, so if I had something like this is p of lambda given p, this should be the same for p and q if it's non-contextual. So if it's non-contextual, you have exactly the same probability distribution, p of lambda given q. So that's its preparation, non-contextual. But if they were different in any way, may only be slightly different, p of lambda given p, and p of lambda given q, this would be preparation contextual. Okay, so that's preparations. What we're talking about here is measurement. We're doing the same thing for measurements. So now a measurement outcome is described by some response function, so it's a conditional probability. Okay, so for every value of the ontic state space, it has to give me a probability between 0 and 1. It doesn't have to integrate to 1 anymore, so a response function might look something like, I don't know, this as some points where it's 0. That might be an example of a response function. So if we have So if we have a measurement procedure M with outcome K that has the same POVM element, then in a measurement non-contextual model, these have to be the same. So this probability of K given M lambda and probability L given N lambda have to be the same function. They'd have to both be the same function. Yeah, and it's measurement contextual if they're different in any way.
Where does this response function live?
So this is lambda. So I'm viewing these as, I'm viewing here these as functions of lambda. So here, the outcome and n that we're considering are fixed, right? This is fixed by, because we're saying, let's look at this measurement outcome pair. So when that's the case, these are now just functions of lambda. So it's a function, it's a measurable function on the ontic state space, right? And the same is true here. And any other questions about that? Okay. Moving on. So measurement, the problem with this notion is that measurement non-contextual models do exist. We saw one, Beltrametti-Bugatsky model yesterday. The response functions are just the quantum probabilities, right? You can see they just depend on the ontic state, and the probability is completely determined by the POVM element here. So if I have two POVM elements that are the same, it'll be the same response function. So done. There's an example of an ontological model. So quotient Speckle context non-contextuality is a more it demands more than just that. So first of all, quotient Speckle non-contextuality only really applies to models that are just about projective measurements. We don't consider arbitrary POVMs. The model has to be measurement non-contextual and also outcome deterministic. So every projection operator, if we consider a projective measurement, every outcome of that measurement either has to get probability zero or probability one in the model. Okay, so when we know lambda, if we know the exact ontic state, everything is determined. Right, so this is either zero or one. Now, you might think, if you don't like outcome determinism, then this isn't a particularly interesting notion. But one thing that Rob Speckens proved is that actually you can prove this by assuming preparation non-contextuality. So if you believe that non-contextuality for both preparations and measurements is reasonable, then you can prove from preparation non-contextuality that you must have this for projective measurements in quantum theory. So I won't do that, but just to say that you can, in principle, get everything from non-contextuality assumptions if you would like to. I will also probably prove tomorrow that proving that something's chaos contextual is actually quite strong because it implies, and particularly implies preparation contextuality, right? So once I've got chaos contextuality, I don't actually need a separate proof of preparation contextuality like I gave there. So even if you don't like outcome determinism, it's still worth proving as a precursor to proving other things that might be more interesting. Okay, so quotient Speckle contextuality, this is the original notion. We can prove that it must be true in Hilbert space dimension 3 or higher. You don't get it for a qubit. And the counterexample for a qubit is the quotient Speckle model, because that is a non-contextual model. Yeah, we can also actually get a proof in D equals 2 if we apply measurement non-contextuality to POVMs. And Speckens did that as well. So you can sort of extend this into dimension 2 in that way. But I'm going to here focus on just the regular quotient Speckle notion. Okay. So due to the outcome determinism assumption, each lambda, whatever the ontic state is, determines like a value function, which just assigns a value 0 or 1 to each projector, right? So I can think about the set of value functions. So that value functions are functions from projectors to 0 or 1. Given an ontic state, I can define such a value function just from the probabilities. Okay, so The point is the value function in general contains less information than the ontic state, because you could have two ontic states that give you exactly the same values, right? So this, what we're doing is sort of compacting down the set, right? All that's really relevant about the ontic state from the point of view of computing probabilities is what value function it corresponds to. So since probabilities have to sum to one, in each projective measurement, right, so for each ontic state, exactly one of the projectors has to get value one and the others get value zero. Because if it's deterministic, they all either get value one or zero. And if the outcomes can exist in the same measurement, then clearly one of them gets probability one and the rest get probability zero. So measurement non-contextuality then implies that the value that we assign to a given projector doesn't depend on which measurement it's part of. Right, so if you consider a three-dimensional Hilbert space, you have an, this is, my hand is showing real three-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So here's an orthogonal basis. This projector onto this state here occurs in this measurement. It also occurs in this measurement where I rotate these two but leave this one the same. And what this assumption says, measurement non-contextuality, is that whether this is assigned value zero or one can't depend on whether I made this measurement or that measurement, right? If it's the same projector, then it must get the same value. Right, so for an orthonormal basis, exactly one vector gets the value one, the rest zero, and this value must be the same for every basis it appears in. Okay, so if we want to prove that Cauchy-Specker non-contextuality is impossible, we can just focus on whether such a value of function like this exists or not. Okay, so let's prove it doesn't. So this is kind of the simplest proof of the Cauchy-Specker theorem, full proof of the Cauchy-Specker theorem. This was discovered in 1996, and it involves 18 vectors, or 18, sometimes called the 18 ray proofs, because what we care about is the projector. You know, global phases don't matter. Okay, so we have 18 quantum states, and this hypergraph here, this diagram here, is depicting the orthogonality structure. So each of the vectors in the Hilbert space is one of these points here, and these different colored sets, these different colored subsets, they all represent orthonormal bases, right? So each of these colored groups of four vertices is a orthonormal basis. So this is obviously happening in a four-dimensional Hilbert space because all of our orthonormal bases have four sets of them. So this is the structure. Okay, so what we've got to show, you have to actually determine that there is a set of vectors in a four-dimensional Hilbert space that have this orthogonality structure. So here they are. I'm not going to verify every single orthogonality relation in this graph, but you can check. You can choose a random one and check, right? So let's see. Phi 9 here should be orthogonal to phi 10. Phi 9 and phi 10, yep, they're orthogonal because the zeros are where the ones are here, etc. Phi 9 should also be orthogonal to phi 2, right? And that's true because I've got a 1 here and I've got a 0 there, etc. So any of the orthogonality relations in this diagram here, you can check for these states. And obviously I can normalize them and they correspond to some quantum set of quantum states. Okay, so that's the structure. Now let's write it out like this, right? So now I'm going to write out, these are the bases. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 bases. So all I've done is take this diagram and underneath red, just list the four states that occur. Okay, so there are 9 bases. For each basis, one of the phi j's has to receive value 1 and the rest have to receive value 0. So in this table here, if I replace these phi's with their values, there will be 9 ones in total, exactly 9 ones in this table. However, if you look, each phi j appears twice in the table. So let's look, phi 1 appears here, and let's see where else is it, and it's there. Okay, and that's it. And similarly for another one, phi 9 is here, and let's see where else is phi 9, there it is, right? So each one appears twice. And the value assigned to one of these can't depend on which basis it's in. So if I assign it the value 1 in one basis, by the non-contextuality, I have to assign it the value 1 in any other basis in which it occurs. So if I start putting 1s in this table, I'm going to have to put them in pairs. Every time I set something to 1, I have to set another box in this table to 1, exactly twice. So there's no way in which there can be an odd number of 1s in this table. It has to be even, because they come in pairs like that. So there'll always be an even number of 1s in total, therefore there's a contradiction. No such value assignment holds. So in order to get around that, either you have to make your ontological model non-deterministic, as in the Beltrametti-Bugatsky, or you have to allow the value to depend on which basis you're measuring. And that's allowed in a general ontological model, because measurement procedure M doesn't, you know, because the response functions in general, are like k given lambda m. So m could include a specification of the basis that you're measuring. Doesn't have to be the same, but it violates non-contextuality. Everybody clear on how that works? All right, this is really just to, if you see this stuff in the literature, this is a very common thing to do. I personally am not a big advocate that this is a very helpful way of thinking about things, but this is the most common way that it gets discussed, so I'm going to talk about it briefly. So if we think previously I thought of value functions as assigning zeros and ones to projectors, but I can also think of them as assigning definite values to self-adjoint operators in the following way. If I write out the Eigen decomposition like this, so it basically says that if the projector pi j gets value 1, then the observable m has eigenvalue mj. That's its value, right? That makes sense. So now, if two observables commute, they have a joint Eigen decomposition. Some of these eigenvalues might be repeated here, but I can find a set of projectors, common set of projectors for both of them. So in that case, when I multiply m with n, I'll just get this, and when I sum m and n, I'll just get this. Okay, so in that case, it tells you that when projectors commute, then the value that I assign to m times n should be the value I assign to n times the value I assign to n, because it would just be the product of the corresponding eigenvalues. And similarly for the sums. Okay, so I can, in principle, so the Cauchy-Speicher non-contextuality assumption implies that the value assumptions assigned to self-adjoint operators obey this sum rule and this product rule whenever the operators commute. Doesn't have to when they don't commute. Okay. Now, typically in quantum mechanics, you define functions of operators by power series anyway. So we can build power series out of these. So it implies that whenever you have a set of operators that mutually commute, the value function of applying a function to all those operators is the same as applying the function to the values assigned to those operators. So another way that some people define KS contextuality is to say, okay, there exists a value function that assigns eigenvalues to all observables that obeys this functional condition for all mutually commuting observables. So that's something that people often say. I think it's better to think of measurement contextuality in the original definition. So we motivate it by this operational equivalence, and then we add outcome determinism. But that's equivalent. Okay, so this is probably the most well-known proof of contextuality, which is based on this kind of idea. Okay, so we have the three Pauli observables and the identity, and let's consider nine of those. So we're again on a four-dimensional Hilbert space, because we have two qubits, and we have these nine observables. And then you can check that each row of this table corresponds to a set of observables that commute. So these three commute, these three commute, these three commute, and similarly for each column, these three commute, these three commute, and these three commute. So each observable here, these are Pauli operators, so the eigenvalues of all these observables are plus or minus one. So in a Cauchy-Speicher non-contextual model, each of these observables is going to receive a value either plus or minus one. Okay, so because each row and column consists of mutually commuting observables, if I, for example, take the product of these three observables, then I have to get that product has to obey like the product rule here. I could extend that to three observables here. Okay, now you can check that so the Pauli observables square to the identity, right? So if I take the product of these three, I get sigma 1 squared times sigma 1 takes the product with sigma 1 squared. I'm just going to get the identity. But the identity only has one eigenvalue, which is 1. So the identity is always going to receive the value 1 in any value function. So what does that tell us? It tells us that I must have an even number of these observables get the value minus 1. So either 0 or 2. Okay. So, but the same is, let's look at the column. So all of the column products are the identity, right? So in every column, there must be an even number of minus 1s. So an even number of minus 1s in total. However, if you multiply out these three observables, you actually get minus the identity. So this tells you that there must be an odd number of ones in this row. Okay, so I'm going to need an even number in this row, an even number in this row, and an odd number in that row. So that means that if I analyze the rows, I say there has to be an odd number of minus ones in the table. If I analyze the columns, it tells me it has to be an even number of minus ones in the table, and that's impossible. That's a contradiction. This proof is actually not much different from this one, because how do you come up with this proof? What you do is you start by looking at this, and you look at the joint eigenvectors of the rows and the columns. So you start with that, that's quite a large set of vectors, and over the years, sort of people noticed that you could prune, take out some of the vectors, and still get a contradiction. So there are more, the joint eigenvectors of this is a larger set than those 18 rays. But people first did that and then noticed that you could sort of take out vectors and still get a contradiction. So that's where that came from. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So the fact that you arrive to a contradiction using this property that the product
yeah.
of the operators has to go to the functions.
Yeah.
To the product of functions, then you're saying that this is contextual.
I'm saying that you can't have that property. So a non-contextual model, a Cauchy-Speicher non-contextual model has to have that property. So this shows that you cannot have a Cauchy-Speicher non-contextual model. Okay. So to reiterate, the possible resolutions of that are to either say the model is fundamentally non-deterministic, like in the Beltrametti-Bugatsky model, for instance, or to say there's actually measurement contextuality, means that so these three observables commute here, and these three observables commute. So there's two ways of measuring this observable. One is I could measure all these three observables at the same time, because they commute, or I could measure all these three observables at the same time. And in a measurement contextual model, this could have a different probability of occurring if I measure this versus if I measure that. Right? So those are the two ways of getting around it. Okay, we are out of time, so I will move on to the other topics tomorrow. Does anybody else have any questions? Okay, if not, I'll see you tomorrow.